State versus Benny Anderson, A15/1620. May have the appearances of counsel, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Nur Magalendran from Miller Meyerson and Corbo on behalf of Benny Anderson.
Good afternoon, Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey. I'm here this afternoon representing the ACLU of New Jersey as well as the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good afternoon, Deputy Attorney General Lauren Bonfiglio on behalf of the state.
Thank you, counsel. Now we have a petition and a cross petition. I thought perhaps if this is acceptable to counsel and for efficiency's sake, counsel for Mr. Anderson, why don't you start by covering both issues, whether this is a fine and then of course the excessiveness argument that your cross petition is focused on.
Certainly, Your Honor. And can I ask for a 2 minutes of rebuttal?
You've got it.
Thank you. May it please the court. Today, Benny Anderson asked this court to address two specific and, in our opinion, straightforward issues. Number one, was there a punitive forfeiture, which implicates the Eighth Amendment? And two, was the forfeiture proportional as required by the Eighth Amendment, given the facts of this individual case? We believe that the answer to the first question is particularly straightforward. In Austin versus United States, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that the Eighth Amendment applies to in rem forfeitures if they are punitive at all, even in part. Here, it is undisputed that the statute is in fact punitive. This much is acknowledged by the state on page 5 of their most recent brief, and the appellate division certainly acknowledged same in its decision. So simply put, on a very basic level, the Eighth Amendment applies to the case at hand because it is punitive. It was a punitive financial measure taken by the government. If the court needs to be further convinced, given the fact that there's this issue that a pension is not an asset as alleged by the state, then the court, we ask, just look to the law of this state, not Tennessee, not Oklahoma, not anywhere else, the law of New Jersey, because the law of New Jersey in this instance on this issue has been consistent for decades. According to my research, the state of New Jersey has had this approach to pensions since 1964, at least. The fact that a pension is an asset is not only recognized by the judiciary, it's recognized by New Jersey statute more specifically. And it's just one example, NJSA 2A 34-23, which states that when a retirement benefit is treated as an asset, income generated will not be included in an alimony analysis. Whitfield versus Whitfield. The New Jersey court found that pension benefits unquestionably constitutes assets. Barr versus Barr. Court says even assets, and Whitfield said this as well, Barr just extended it, that a pension that hasn't matured is an asset. Oracoli not only referred to pensions as assets, but treated its forfeiture as a penalty. So I think Oracoli is particularly helpful in this regard. But in all of the cases cited, the slew of cases, these are just some of them, wherein pensions are treated as assets, it's my belief that the most helpful case is Whitfield versus Whitfield. Because in Whitfield versus Whitfield, the court rejected squarely the very same argument that the state is making here, which is that Benny Anderson didn't have a pension, didn't have an asset, because he failed to meet a condition. Well, the husband in Whitfield made that very same argument, said, I've been in the military. I get a pension at 20 years. I have to be in the military for 20 years before I have a pension. So it's not an asset. And the court said nonsense to me, to put it bluntly, because they were impassioned in rejecting this argument. They said specifically, clearly, this pension will not be earned on the 20th anniversary of his entry into the service. Rather, it's earned each and every day that he showed up for work. And that's exactly what happened here. Benny Anderson earned his pension over 38 years by showing up each and every day, perhaps with exception, but he secured this asset. He secured his pension. Of critical importance in this matter is that Benny Anderson's argument that this is an asset and therefore implicates the Eighth Amendment is more compelling than any of the cases I've cited. Because in Benny Anderson's case, unlike Whitfield, unlike Barr, and unlike State v. Ventacourt from Massachusetts, Benny Anderson's pension was vested. And he was in pay status. He was getting his check every month, I believe for years, before the state intervened and diverted his funds, seized his funds, transferred his funds to their own coffers. And in a very literal sense, this is exactly the type of situation that implicates the Eighth Amendment because it's government taking an individual's money, an epitome of a situation where the Eighth Amendment applies. I think of particular use is the case of Benton Court from Massachusetts.
Before we move on to other states, and I know you started your focus on New Jersey cases, the trial court emphasized a series of New Jersey cases that talked about our law really leaning more in the direction of this being a contract right. And one that recognized that there has been a longstanding expectation that it was conditioned on honorable service. And in fact, Urkulli even talks about the expectation of honorable service being of longstanding stature here in New Jersey. Can you address that or would you like to address that, please?
I would like to address that. Now, in reviewing the trial court's transcript, Your Honor, to the best of my recall, it boiled down to the judge's belief, a judge who was very sympathetic to the set of circumstances faced by Mr. Anderson, Benny Anderson. The trial court's decision came down to, I'd like to do right by Mr. Anderson, but I can't because, and she relies almost exclusively on decisions from foreign jurisdictions which found that pensions are not assets, okay? Tennessee, Oklahoma. Now, the only reason that Benny Anderson did not get a proportionality review from the trial court, to my recall, is because the judge felt that the Eighth Amendment did not apply. Well, now yeah, the
counsel, I thought the primary focus of the trial court was her reading of the statute.
Well,
and her view that legislative intent was clear, that it was a harsh measure. But it was justified by public policy, and that she was viewing this to be what the legislature wanted to have happen. I understand she cited cases, but that was the focus. I thought
I respectfully tend to disagree in terms of what I recall her focus as being. I recall, again, I'm working on recall on this one, but I recall something like, okay, I don't have anything. Which, and she's talking about foreign jurisdictions, but yes, she did mention legislative history and the contents of the statute. But we now know, and now it's been established and it's not even disputed, that even though the statute calls for a mandatory seizure, okay, or a mandatory forfeiture, the Eighth Amendment applies. The appellate division found that to be true. And I don't think there's any getting around that given the fact that this statute is punitive. If it's punitive, the Eighth Amendment and the legislative intent and the language of the statute is subject to the strictures of the Eighth Amendment.
Yes, once there's a property interest, I'm just trying to understand what the trial court did. So tell me if I'm mistaken. And I think this is what divided the trial court from the appellate division. The trial court was saying that honorable service was a precondition for the right to pension. And if you haven't completed honorable service, then you don't have a right to a pension, period. Whereas the appellate division was taking this deferred compensation approach. Yes, you have a property interest, but there was no violation of the excessive fines clause. Am I right about the way this broke down?
Yes, and if I can answer that in a little bit more detail.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, admittedly, the trial court was not made aware of the State versus Benton court decision. And the trial court was not, to the best of my knowledge, was not made aware of Whitfield versus Whitfield and Barr versus Barr. Now, the appellate division was, and the appellate division relied largely on those three cases almost entirely on those three cases, two of which are from this jurisdiction, okay, and Oracoli from this court in rendering the decision that the Eighth Amendment applied. Because even under Whitfield and under Barr and under Benton court, even if a condition precedent is not met, this pension is an asset. And it's also, I'm getting a little, you know, I'm working on recall here because it's been so long since that we were in front of the trial court. So I'm approaching this cautiously, okay, gingerly. But it's also, to my recall, okay, the argument that the Eighth Amendment applies to any punitive taking. To my recall, I don't know what's presented to the trial court. It is something that the appellate division recognized. Quite frankly, it wasn't the focus of our brief, but the appellate division recognized that. And
yeah, I think the trial court said there was nothing to take because you didn't earn it. Whereas the appellate division said, okay, you earned it, but the forfeiture was not excessive. Given
correct.
The nature of the offense. I think
correct.
That's okay.
And the appellate division's analysis was moving away from a contractual analysis to this property right, as Justice Albin mentioned. But if the court looks at some other case law that is outside of the family law area that focuses on pension statutes and rights under it, and sees that there's a more consistent theme that is aligned with a contract analysis, I'd like you to deal with the honorable service condition of that contractual promise.
Well, I certainly, because if it's a contractual promise, we have to recognize the fact that this is the contractual nature of it, it's by statute. It's a government action, obviously. And because it's a statute and because it is punitive in its effect, again, I think we get past the threshold requirement because even if there's a condition, and I know Your Honor is saying away from the matrimonial, but because this statute requires a forfeiture, and admittedly a complete forfeiture, I think that the first threshold question is in our favor. It must be answered in our favor. I hope I'm answering Your Honor's question, because to me, whether it's in the matrimonial realm or not, that condition precedent becomes almost secondary to the fact that we're dealing with a punitive statute. And if it's a punitive statute, as per Austin, as per the US Supreme Court, an Eighth Amendment at proportionality analysis is absolutely necessary and required. And if I might, again, Benton Court, I think, spoke, Justice LaVecchia, to Your Honor's point, and I think the appellate division here did too, because under Benton Court and under Anderson, the appellate division, just because something is contractual,
and conditioned on honorable service,
doesn't make it a non-asset because it's deferred. It's a deferred compensation. And
that's putting the rabbit into the hat, because it's another way of saying that it's a property right. as opposed to something that has to requires ongoing honorable service.
It might, but I think that's the reality of it, is that it is a yes. Can we ignore or disregard the fact that this was contractual in nature? We cannot, and we are being.
Well, can I ask you this? Are you fashioning a categorical challenge to the statute? Are you saying that the legislature may not require complete forfeiture for a certain listing of offenses that directly touch on the performance of a public position or office?
No. What we are saying is that in this situation, ultimately, the appellate division failed to apply an Eighth Amendment analysis, and that an Eighth Amendment analysis applies to this statute. Are there situations where a mandatory forfeiture would be absolutely justified and not excessive? Of course there are. I'm glad if I may be so bold that Justice LaVecchia, you asked that question, because just take the situation as it exists here. Benny Anderson served his city honorably for 38 years, barring one conviction, for a $300 bribe, okay? Benny Anderson, under the appellate court's approach, latter approach on the latter issue, if Benny Anderson had engaged in a scheme whereby homeowners lost millions of dollars, where the city lost millions of dollars, if he engaged in a conspiracy over the course of 20 years, 40 years, because he worked there 38, his penalty would be the same as it is for a $300 solitary bribe. Mm-hmm. And that's the exact type of result or inconsistency that I think that the excessive fines clause exists to prevent.
And now, so have you calculated the loss that was inflicted on your client as a result of, I'll just use this term for our purpose now, the forfeiture of his pension? Have you multiplied the loss?
I thought I did at one point, meaning how much he took versus how much he...
No, how much he, if his pension were not forfeited, how much money he would have earned given the probable lifetime he would have lived. I'm saying that because I don't know if it's correct. I did a rough calculation based upon, you know, life probability of living for a person his age, and it came to approximately, it could be off, $1.4 million. Have you done any calculation?
I started off at one point and took the full amount because the full amount was taken. I believe my number was slightly lower. Okay, but it's significant. It is in excess of six figures. Admittedly, I'm an honest attorney. I heard the last argument, but what I'm saying is I'm pretty sure I didn't get to 1.4, but it was north of a million. Okay. So if
I'm asking, it's an important number. If you're arguing that it's an excessive fine, you got to know what the fine is.
Right? My calculation was over a million, okay? And that's for $300. But, you know, I think Benny Anderson has health issues. And even if we're gonna be pessimistic about his life expectancy, we're talking thousands of times the bribe he took. So, I think that speaks for itself. Now, Justice Albin, I'm happy you asked that question. Because one thing the appellate division didn't do, and I think this is glaring, is consider the impact of the fine an individual analysis like Your Honor just did on Benny Anderson. Because that is what the excessive fines clause is is supposed to prevent, if nothing else, which is a devastating financial penalty by the government on an individual. And that's
grossly disproportionate.
Grossly, I
think, is part of the language of so the question is, and no one's minimizing the nature of this offense. This is public corruption for $300 bribe. Does that equate to $1 million fine? Assuming that the pension can be considered a property interest in something that has been forfeited.
Correct. But I would take it just maybe a step further than that, because to my knowledge, this was his only livelihood. This was his only income. And what the US Supreme Court has said is that Justice Ginsburg put it more eloquently than anyone, I think, in Timms versus Indiana, that it's as old as the Magna Carta, is that it has to be proportional to the wrong and not be so large as to deprive an offender of his livelihood. And that's what happened here.
Well, Timms involved an in rem forfeiture. And you made that assertion at the outset, but I believe that that's contested, that this is not an in rem, this is an in personam forfeiture related to his criminal offense.
I believe it's conceded. I will let counsel explain that, but on page 5 of their brief, they're saying the statute is punitive. This is a punitive action by the government. And my understanding of going through the US Supreme Court law is both in rem and in personam, financial penalties are subject to the strictures of the Eighth Amendment.
The Bahakashian case doesn't impose a nexus requirement, does it?
Nexus requirement, Your Honor, I'm sorry, as to
related to the amount and the offense that was committed.
I have those factors right there. I believe that Bajikashian, I thought, meaning a nexus between the amount taken, the amount of the crime and the amount of the penalty.
Yes.
I believe, can Your Honors just bear with me for a second?
It just didn't reach that issue.
Not in so, right. I'm looking at the four factors and
okay.
That's correct. But I think there's plenty of case law which, including Timms, which says it has to be proportional. There's cases, I believe, before Bakaji. And if I might, what we're asking again, Judge, is Your Honors, what we want is a consistent approach that's based largely on New Jersey law. And if one thing that this state should be commended for is that the state has routinely provided people in Benny Anderson's position more protections than the US Supreme Court, whether it's civil penalties, whether it's death penalty, whether it's juvenile offenders. When it comes to civil penalties, you can look at Oracoli. You can also look for this very limited—
You look program. At Oracoli, what I see in it is that Justice Handler relied largely on the fact that there had been legislative inaction ever saying that that the legislature wanted automatic and mandatory forfeiture for offenses directly touching the public office or public position held by the pensioner.
And
now we have it.
And Oracoli, though, did not invite the legislature to enact a law that either at its core or in its enforcement would result in unconstitutional results. Now,
I don't see a whiff of a constitutional argument in Uricoli. Uricoli, and I'm looking at page 77, says we cannot therefore attribute to the legislature in the statutory creation of public pensions an intent to impose and retain an inflexible forfeiture rule. And it emphasizes that there is no legislative statute that demands that, that says that, and it acknowledges it had been a construction of some judicial decisions. But and now we have, in 2007, the legislature speaking, and this is what the trial court was emphasizing, in rather unmistakable terms that they expect forfeiture for these specific offenses to be immediate and inflexible, mandatory.
Can I respond?
That's the problem.
I understand that is that's an issue, but every piece of legislation is subject to the Constitution. And is the Constitution, which part of the Constitution impacts this law, this statute? Because it's punitive, because it's an asset, it's the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause. The legislature is free to do what it wants. That doesn't mean that the judiciary, I respectfully submit, must step in and apply the Constitution.
You accept the fact that the statute, the clear language of the statute is to impose this forfeiture of the pension. Your argument is that it violates the excessive fines clause. That's your position.
My argument is that the excessive fines clause applies and it's violative of that. And in terms of violative of that, I just ask this court to remain consistent with its own approach in past years. There have been in past cases because, and Justice LaVecchia, you brought it up, that there Baja Kasian, I always have trouble pronouncing that. With my last name, I should be better at it. But here's the thing. Your Honor is correct. But New Jersey law and New Jersey precedent and New Jersey jurisprudence has got to play a significant role here. And what the courts have considered in the past in judging civil penalties is the ability of a defendant to pay, the amount of profit obtained from illegal activity, the actual injury to the public, the duration of the conspiracy, the existence of criminal actions. All of these factors weigh against a full forfeiture, a complete $1 million plus fine on Benny Anderson, who took $300. So, Your Honors, I think unless there's any other questions, I would just like to make some closing comments. Benny Anderson is one of 13 children. He was born in an economically impoverished neighborhood here in Jersey City. He served his country honorably in Vietnam and went on to serve his city for 38 years. He held every position at the Jersey City Board except for assessor. He made a mistake, a $300 mistake that has implications. We understand that. But if I can just summarize what the Eighth Amendment stands for, is let the punishment fit the crime and let the facts and circumstances of this individual case determine proportionality. That's all we ask for. And I respectfully submit that's mandated and precedented both by the US Supreme Court and the New Jersey jurisprudence in perhaps complementary ways. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shalom.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'd like to take a stab at both of the questions the court is tasked with answering. Like defense counsel, I believe that there is a simple solution, and the solution is found in Austin. Austin essentially tells the court, fines and fees and forfeitures take all sorts of different forms. Sometimes they're called one thing or the other. Sometimes they're in personam, sometimes they're in rem. But the bottom line is, if you're trying to figure out whether or not the Eighth Amendment applies, and let me just step back for 1 second and say, when I say the Eighth Amendment, I'm being sloppy and using shorthand. I mean both the Eighth Amendment and Article 1, Paragraph 12. But the way to figure out whether the Eighth Amendment applies is the financial penalty financial sanction in part punitive. It is. We know that because the Attorney General has conceded that it is here on, as defense counsel says, on page 5 of their brief, they say it's punitive. So it's about substance rather than form. We can call it one thing or call it the other, but it's the government taking money from its citizens as a penalty. That is punitive. That is subject to the Eighth Amendment analysis. But let me add one additional angle, which you've already heard about, but perhaps a different gloss on it. Justice Scalia, in a case about the other clause of the Eighth Amendment, in a cruel and unusual punishment clause case, explained that we need to be particularly skeptical of government behavior when the government stands to benefit. So this is in Harmelin versus Michigan. And he says, look, a fine is something where the government stands to benefit because it enriches their coffers, as opposed to imprisonment, which actually costs the government money. So he says, we have to have this jaundiced eye when we're looking at government behavior that enriches the government. And so imagine what it would mean to say that this is a contract and not property. It would mean that for matrimonial purposes, we call it property. But when the government might be held to account, might be taken to task, then we have to change our lens. That's the sort of thing where if we're being skeptical of the government, as Justice Scalia tells us we must be in the context of fines, would look awfully funny if the divorcing person needs to list it as an asset, but the government can't count it as an asset.
Mr. Schlund, that's because family court's a court of equity, and that is premised on purely equitable principles, fairness and equality between the parties. That's not necessarily what punishment is, isn't it? I mean, how do you translate the family court's equitable principles to the principle of punishment for an offense committed in the course of your official duties?
So again, Justice Solomon, I think the clearest way to do it is simply by saying Austin versus United States, this is a financial extraction of money or of something of value by the government. It is punitive. That ends the inquiry. The reference to matrimonial law is, I think, just another lens. And I take your distinction on law versus equity. But ultimately, if it was fair in the one context, it seems particularly unfair to exclude it from judicial scrutiny when it's the government who's taking it. And ultimately, that's what the second question asks you to do. It's not to say, was this, did he do something wrong? It's simply to say, do judges have a role in deciding whether the seizure, the fine, is grossly disproportionate to the action? And so, Justice LaVecchia, you asked a question about whether defense counsel was moving for a categorical rule. And he answered that he was not. But to be clear, your question was, can the legislature fashion a total, complete, mandatory forfeiture? And the answer is, of course they can. But what they cannot do is say, we're going to fashion this mandatory forfeiture that then escapes the Eighth Amendment. It is still subject to Eighth Amendment individualized proportionality analysis.
And that's why we come back to the state law question of whether or not this is something that is being taken away when it hasn't fully been given to the individual in the first instance. If it depends on how one views the condition of honorable service. If it is something that has to happen in order for the pension to, one, be paid in the first instance, and two, continue to be paid if the wrongdoing is discovered after someone has already begun to draw a pension, then the person is not losing something that which he had an absolute right to have. And other courts have held that. I mean, that's what Judge Jacobson was pointing to, and that's what case law in New Jersey has pointed to as well. And we have numerous statutes that have talked about and preserved the right of forfeiture, not only 43.1-3.3, but also Chapter 78, when it was putting in a non-forfeitable right that related to the funding of pensions, but contains a separate subsection in the same section that says nothing herein will take away the state's right to continue to forfeit pensions. And I paraphrase it, so
forgive me. Of course. But to be clear, Eighth Amendment analysis also doesn't take away the state's right to forfeit pensions. It simply imposes a limitation upon it that that forfeiture must not be grossly disproportionate.
Well, you only get to disproportionality if you're taking away something that somebody had an absolute right to say was theirs and theirs alone and was untouchable.
I'm not sure, Justice Lavecchia, that that's right, that the touchstone of property is an absolute right. I mean, a conditional right might also be a property interest. For example, if I owned a stock option and you took away that stock option, you meaning the government took away that stock option, that would be a taking of my property, even whether I had exercised it or not, because there's a value to it. And in the same way, there's a value to Mr. Anderson in the expected pension forfeiture.
With that said, the law that I'm referring to, Mr. Shalom, just to be clear, is the line that I'm sure every advocate here knows. It's Spina, your Coley, Berg, Burgos. I mean, there are numerous ones. There's the ones Cavelli, the McCann. There are many, many ones that talk about this. So, and they don't talk about it in terms of a property right. The court has studiously avoided a categorical statement that it is a pension right and has talked more aligned with contract rights each and every time it's come close to trying to fix a label on something that is mutable.
Like defense counsel, I think that if you're looking at which analysis makes the most sense, I think the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts does a compelling job. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree that reasonable people can disagree about it.
Our law may not be crystal clear. We've said many times that a pension is deferred compensation. We said it in Corvelli. I'm looking at, I'm quoting, the Uricoli balancing test was our answer in weighing the prevailing view of pensions as deferred compensation, .. You've said that a number of times. And the question that Justice Lavecchia is really boring down on is, and this is the first issue, is whether or not the defendant here has a property interest. If he has a property interest, then it's going to be subject to the excessive fines clause. If he has nothing, then there's nothing to take from him. So go ahead.
I agree. If the court decides that the appellate division was wrong as to the threshold question, the court need not address the subsequent question of whether the appellate division's analysis under the Eighth Amendment and Article 1, Paragraph 12 was flawed. In the event that you agree with me that the appellate division got the first question right, I'd like to explain why I think they got the second question wrong.
But before you leave the first question, which there appears to be quite a bit of interest in this virtual room, how do we, without departing from Spina, from our more recent cases, Burgos and Berg, and Urticoli, and the line of cases that very carefully expressed what this right is and what is not, and overall upheld the legislature's ability to take actions of varying kinds that affected that ability to collect a pension. How do we get to your constitutional point, which is the Eighth Amendment applies because this is a forfeiture, without undoing all that case law, which was not a criminal action, which is largely interpreting statutory intent and not finding it to be what you describe as an absolute right that's ultimately taken away?
I think because Austin gives us the easiest route to do so, wherein it asks whether it's punitive. And I think the state's concession that the forfeiture of this pension was punitive is both the end, should be both the end of the inquiry and sufficient justification for this court's divergence from some of its non-criminal side jurisprudence, which has been less clear on whether we're talking about a fine or a contract interest.
But if we, if this truly is a conditional, a future right that, that someone would have conditioned on honorable service, how do you get to it being a fine at all? I understand the punitive argument, but to me, that's not the heart of it.
I guess if you don't think that's the heart of it, then I don't know that you do get there. I think that is the heart of it. I think otherwise we're focused on form over substance. And we're saying to the government, if you dress it up, if you call it something different, you can extract from the citizenry money. And it's irrelevant whether it's money owed or money that they must pay. That seems...
With that last point, I'm not so sure about. You know,
Let me give you an example, Justice Patterson, that I hope illustrates the point. If we all agree that fining someone $100,000 for jaywalking would be an excessive fine under the Eighth Amendment, to take kind of an uncontroversial example, it makes, if someone gets arrested with $200,000 in their pocket and that money is temporarily seized, and then instead of giving them back $200,000, the government only gives them back $100,000.
Respectfully, Mr. Shalom, you know, your analogies are usually right on the mark. I don't think this one is. And the reason I say that is because these pensions are creatures of statute. They wouldn't exist but for statutes. And the legislature has carefully characterized what they are and what they are not over a period of many years and a succession of statutes. A couple of, you know, obviously Chapter 78 is a relatively recent one. So if somebody has $200,000, it's theirs, it's forfeited, there's a legal proceeding for forfeiture and they only give back $100,000. To me, that's a very clear case. The issue is whether the money that has been forfeited in this case was ever truly his, Mr. Anderson's.
I agree that that's the question, Justice Patterson. And as I said, I concede that if I haven't convinced you on point one, point two becomes irrelevant, but in hopes that that my analogies make more sense when you get into conference, I'd like to turn to the second question.
Go right ahead.
Thank you.
By all means.
So Justice Patterson, you asked earlier, you noted that the trial court did defer very significantly to the legislative intent, and I don't disagree that the legislative intent is crystal clear. The legislature wants to enact complete, total, mandatory forfeitures in all these cases. But assuming that it's a property right, we have this separate question of does the Eighth Amendment and does Article 1, Paragraph 12 allow it? And I believe that a very straightforward analysis under Bajikagian says that the appellate division got this wrong. Bajikagian asks about the amount of the forfeiture. They ask about the gravity of the underlying offense. And on the gravity of the underlying offense, the appellate division focused on, well, look, the statutory maximum for this offense was 20 years. But what they didn't focus on is anything about the gravity of the offense that's found beyond the crime of conviction. So for example, what did the guideline range qualify Mr. Anderson for in federal court? And what was the sentence imposed? So the fact that he got 6 months of house arrest when he was exposed to 20 years suggests that the federal judge found that the gravity of the offense among the pantheon of these sorts of official misconduct offenses was quite low. And we know from Bajikagian that that's the right analysis, because Mr. Bajikagian also committed a crime that is sometimes very serious. It is sometimes the tool of money launderers and drug dealers. But in fact, in his case, he was going to repay an honest debt. And so what the court there looked at is not what was the maximum exposure, the statutory maximum, but what did the guideline range call for, and said, therefore, we think it's a less serious version. The appellate division didn't do that at all. They just looked at the maximum exposure. Same thing with the maximum penalties and the nature and degree of the harm. We're not asking a theoretical question about whether this statute ever causes harm, which of course it does, but how much harm was caused in this case.
I don't want to minimize this offense, but was this a sting operation? Was this a government informant who approached
My understanding, Anderson. Justice Albin, my understanding is that it was a government informant, but it was actually a government informant after the fact, which is to say someone got pinched years later and then came to the government and said, oh, by the way, I've got this one thing I can tell you about with Mr. Anderson. And they had one thing. So it's not the case where in 38 years he only got caught once. To the best of our knowledge, there is a single incident here. But I actually am not certain that any of that is in the record. And so I'm happy to move past it. Justice Leavecchia, you asked about individual financial circumstances and whether that's considered in Bajikagian. And it is not, but it is explicitly noted the reason why it is not. And that's because it was waived below. Because Mr. Bajikagian's lawyer didn't at the district court level raise a concern about what it would mean for his client and whether it would render him destitute. But in Timms, Justice Ginsburg really walks through the Anglo-American jurisprudence to make clear that the concern that animated the Eighth Amendment and each of the states that adopted an excessive fines clause was leaving people without money, leaving people destitute, emerciments. And so it seems very likely that this will become a requirement imposed by the United States Supreme Court.
At least in this case, if his pension is totally forfeited, Anderson will be basically pauperized. I mean, this is a guy seriously ill, depending upon his upon his pension, and may very well have to seek public assistance.
That's exactly right. And so I want to say one more word on the question of ability to pay, because the state takes a surprising tact in their brief where they say, we can't analyze for ability to pay because we need uniformity in sentencing. And so the way to get uniformity is to just do mandatory sentencing. And that's not actually a view of uniformity that this court has ever adopted in its sentencing jurisprudence or in its fines and fees jurisprudence, which is to say, to treat, we don't fine princes and paupers the same amount, because that then that is not uniform. We are able to make distinctions, and trial courts do that every day when they do ability to pay hearings on fines and on fees. And so I don't understand why it would be for a fine of $100,000 in a drug conviction, we can ask, what will this mean for the person's personal financial situation? But in a forfeiture situation, we can't. It's a pretty straightforward inquiry. Justice Leavecchia, did you have a question? I saw you unmute.
I'm listening to your argument, Mr. Shalom, and I know you were nodding before when I asked counsel for Mr. Anderson whether or not this is a categorical challenge. It sure sounds like it.
I don't think it is in the following sense. It is the categorical rule that I think is appropriate is that the legislature cannot escape scrutiny from the Eighth Amendment by classifying a crime as mandatory, just like, and I cite in my brief the death penalty cases in the post-Furman world, where a couple states said, we're going to solve this arbitrary and capricious problem by just giving everyone the death penalty. And the Supreme Court said, that doesn't fix your problem. It just shifts it slightly. So they can't escape it. But in some cases, total forfeiture would be absolutely appropriate. It would depend at least on the Bajikagian factors and the person's individual financial circumstances. So for example, if Mr. Anderson, rather than having worked 38 years, had worked 15 years and was still at an age where he could continue to work, then the financial side questions are less impactful. Or if the gravity of the crime was sufficiently high, a series of frauds and misrepresentations, that changes the question. Again, Justice Albin identified it, it's gross disproportionality. And so
if he took $300 every year, you probably wouldn't be making your argument.
We'd be having a very different conversation, Justice Albin. We certainly would, without a doubt. I mean, even if he did it three or four times, which might suggest there was more of a continuing pattern.
But that analysis is then treating the amount of the wrongdoing, the amount that was paid in the bribe, as essentially an instrumentality of the offense. And that is not the structure of the analysis that we should be using here.
So Justice Levecchia, I agree, and I want to be clear. I'm not suggesting that because it was a single $300 bribe, what they're allowed to do is reduce his pension by $300. Mm-hmm. In fact, Jersey City reduced his pension by $12,000 per year.
Well, doesn't that action, and which he accepted, doesn't right. that action indicate that he never regarded his pension as inviolate to begin with? He didn't challenge that. And he obviously accepted the fact that forfeiture of the pension was possible. So the whole argument that this is a fine, a penalty, that then triggers the excessiveness argument is a bit undermined.
I don't think it is, Justice Levecchia, because two points. First of all, I don't think to call it a property right is to say it's inviolate. It doesn't mean it can't be seized. It just means it can't be seized for in a way that makes it excessive. And so had the wrong been significant enough, they could take the whole thing. And I think the acceptance of the failure to challenge the $12,000 portion suggests that we recognize that he committed a crime, or he recognizes, I certainly had no role in it, but that he recognizes that he committed a crime and that there are penalties to be borne for having done so. But when the penalty gets to total forfeiture, that's when it becomes unreasonable and triggers the protections of the Eighth Amendment. Unless the court has any further questions, I'm grateful for your time.
Any questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Shalom. Ms. Bonfiglio, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. May I also reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary?
This is awkward because we have the petition and the cross petition, but if there is something that you feel the need to respond to shortly after on your application, then we'll hear you briefly.
You know what? I probably won't need it, but thank you. May I please the court? The heart of the issue in this case is not whether the statute is punitive, right? The heart of the issue is whether defendants pension would constitute property and the taking of which would implicate the Eighth Amendment. The forfeiture of defendant's pension, as mandated by our legislature, is simply not a taking of his property and paying to the state of New Jersey. He is not paying a dime out of his pocket, but instead he's just not going to receive something that he did not earn. While a person's property has constitutional protections, the scope of a property right is defined by state law. In New Jersey, honorable service is both an express and implied condition precedent to receipt of a public pension. And without it, along with the other requirements for obtaining a public pension, there is simply no cognizable property interest. And it is neither unconscionable nor unreasonable to require honesty and integrity during an employee's tenure in public service. When defendant accepted a bribe to illegally alter a tax description, which no one disputes involved or touched his public employment, he failed to satisfy the condition of honorable service that is necessary to be eligible for a public pension. As a result, his pension is not property that ever belonged to him. Disqualifying defendant from receiving those unearned benefits, therefore, does not constitute a payment of his property to the state of New Jersey, so the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause is not even implicated, and it's certainly not violated. For all of these reasons, defendant has failed to meet his heavy burden of overcoming the statute's presumed constitutionality, and this court should affirm the forfeiture order, but clarify that the Eighth Amendment does not apply because there was no fine in this case.
You intend to address the arguments on the excessiveness aspect that was advanced by your adversary?
Sure. So first of all, the only way this court would need to reach that issue were if it were to find that defendant still has a property interest, even though he failed to satisfy the condition required to obtain.
Understood. This is an alternative to your first argument.
So I'm going to pronounce it differently, but Bajakajan, the United States Supreme Court case, would govern, right? It's the four factors, and that's exactly what the appellate division did in this case, and that would be appropriate. And the state does want to clarify that this is not an in-rem forfeiture. All of the other cases that are citing to an in-rem forfeiture are certainly not applicable. The state believes, if you were to answer this question, the appellate division's decision was certainly reasonable. It covered all of the factors and it addressed the competing, you know, the interests of the public in this case. And if I can, I just want to point out how unfair it is for defendant to fault the appellate division here, because in every court he was in and in every brief he filed, the request changed, right? And it's his burden to prove that the statute is excessive or is constitutionally, is not constitutional, right? So in the trial court, defendant basically just said, this is excessive, I have health issues, right? In the appellate division, he didn't cite Bajakajan. He cited a case that was similar, but didn't even look to the circumstance, as many circumstances as Bajakajan did, right? Then in the petition for certification to this court, he says, this court should adopt the Uricoli factors. Now, and then finally in the supplemental brief, in response to our brief, he said Bajakajan plus some antitrust case should be considered. So the request keeps changing. And along those lines too, it's defense counsel said he doesn't even know what property defendant has. He doesn't know the amount of the total forfeiture. Well, how can
what is the state's position on who got it right, if anyone, in the two opinions we're reviewing here, the trial court, Judge Jacobson's opinion and the appellate division, with respect to what this right is? You know, as you know, there were two different, Judge Jacobson's characterization and the appellate division's characterization are different. Do you agree with both of them? Do you agree with one more than the other? Obviously you're here representing the state and talking about a statute that the legislature passed.
Okay, so certainly Judge Jacobson's analysis was correct, right? But at the same time, New Jersey has, or our courts have been, we don't like to define something as a contract, right? Right, because it's presumed not to be a contract. But along those lines, the appellate division here found that there was a property right, aside from the marital law context, which obviously is distinguishable, but they based it on the Betancourt decision, right? But what's crucial in that case is how Massachusetts defines its property right, right? Because a property right is, the scope of a property right is defined by state law. And in Betancourt in Massachusetts, the legislature defines honorable service the Massachusetts statutes define a property right this from the moment that a pensioner contributes to a pension system, right? So it's a condition subsequent. And so they always had a property right interest in the pension. Our statutes are completely different. We classify it as a condition precedent that must be satisfied in order for a property right to attach. So I believe that the correct analysis would be a property analysis, but we can't rely on Massachusetts for that because of those reasons. And sorry, did you have a question?
No. So
what is this right that he has in these pension payments?
So at this point, defendant would have a conditional right subject to certain conditions being met, right?
A conditional property right.
It would be a conditional property right, but it would only mature at the time of retirement when all of the conditions have been met. And there is New Jersey, there is our court, this court, there's support in this court's precedent, right? It's Plunkett v. Board, and it's from 1935. It's cited in Spina, it's cited in footnote in Spina. And in that case, this court held that there is no vested property right until the time of retirement when the conditions have been met. Same thing for, it's McQuinsky v. State. It's 76 New Jersey, 87, 1978. They both say the same thing. There is no vested.
Okay, so let me stop you there. Are you saying that before I retire, which is the moment that my pension can be taken away from me? I haven't reached, let's say I have not reached the maximum age. For retirement, are you saying that my entire pension can be forfeited?
No, of course not. What I'm saying is at the time of retirement, you have to meet certain conditions. One is either retirement age or certain years of service. And two is you have to serve honorably the entire time. Only at that point at retirement, when both of those conditions have been met, is there any interest in a property, or is there any property interest in a pension?
So when you define it that way, you have to be right. I mean, if that's no, if that's the way it is, then it's over. So the only remaining question is whether or not a pension can be deemed to be deferred compensation, which we've referred to numerous times in numerous cases. Even Spina talks about a pension as a property right. So if it was earned at the time that the person rendered service, then there's one argument: you can't take it away. If you're right, you don't have anything until that last day on which we're assured that you have performed honorable service. Well, then it's a different way. And those are the two angles that we have here. Yes?
Yes, but to the extent it's called deferred compensation, it's still conditioned on that requirement of honorable service in order to be eligible for a pension. And it's chapter one of Title 43. It's titled, is what's at issue here, it's titled eligibility for pension fund. So without those two conditions, you simply cannot be eligible to receive a public pension. And it's a public pension, it's funded by taxes.
So, from your perspective, wouldn't make a difference if it was a $300 bribe or a $10 bribe. If this was a $10 bribe, your argument would be the same. You forfeit your $1 million pension, despite the fact that you have performed services honorably for 38 years until the 38th year and second day. Your position would be on that second day of the 38th year, $10 bribe, you lose everything that you would have otherwise been entitled to for the 38 years. That's your position, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And it's totally consistent with the two cases I just cited. That is the law in New Jersey, and that's what has to be the law in New Jersey.
If deferred compensation, if that means that you have an absolute property right in your pension, that would mean that to the extent that someone who hasn't reached the requisite number of years and never does, has still worked for a number of years in the job, they would be entitled to that compensation, notwithstanding the fact that the pension statutes make it clear that they're not eligible, right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Your point is that deferred compensation is not antithetical to the limitations that you are arguing apply to these pensions.
Right. That's exactly right. And that's the problem with the legal fiction that the appellate division created here by classifying this as a property right, even though it could never be earned because the condition has not been satisfied for the person to be eligible to receive it. Right. And as Justice Lavecchia noted, oh, I'm sorry, Justice Patterson noted before, pensions are a creature of the legislature. The legislature has given us a pension in the statutes, and it is for them, it is legislative policy to determine the terms and conditions of that service. So defendant certainly has failed to meet his very heavy burden here of overcoming the statute's presumed constitutionality. And before I forget, if I could just clarify one date for the record, defendant pleaded guilty in federal court here on November 21st, 2017. That is the date that matters. To the extent it's stated otherwise in any of the briefs, this is the correct date.
Can I ask you a question about the honorable services statute? So it went into effect on the 18th year of his service. So when he began his public employment, that is Mr. Anderson, this honorable services statute didn't exist. What happens to the first 18 years? And does the honorable services statute change? So let's say up to the honorable services statute, it was deferred compensation without the condition of honorable services. Does the statute on the 18th year change what happened for the first 18 years? Are you following me?
Sort of. If I understand your question, I'll try to answer it. So it's my understanding that the pension laws at the time of retirement govern. But regardless of whether there was an express provision or not at the time he began his service, in Corvelli, this court noted that honorable service has been an implied condition precedent to all public to receipt of a public pension in this state. And as far back as at least I can tell, 1935, this court has described honorable service as a.
So you're right about no one's contesting that, but under Uricoli,
right?
This court created a multi-factor test to determine how much of your if you wind up committing a crime, how much of your pension would be lost. Part of it, maybe all of it, depending on how all those factors were weighed. It wasn't until the statute was enacted that the legislature made it clear that it was intending a total forfeiture, basically overruling Uricoli. So my question is, for the first 18 years, that statute wasn't in effect. Does he have some vested right for the first 18 years?
No, Your Honor. It would be according to the laws at the time of retirement. And as Justice LaVecchia pointed out earlier, Uricoli was a matter of statutory construction. There was not an explicit intent or legislative intent to require mandatory forfeiture, and this court was not willing to write that into the statute. After Uricoli, the legislature had adopted the Uricoli factors, and now that's in the discretionary statute. However, because of the unmistakable pervasiveness of public corruption in our society, the legislature in 2007 created this mandatory pension forfeiture statute. And that's what
got certain crimes.
For certain crimes that
touching on public office or position.
Right.
In Uricoli, there are numerous cases cited about by our court and through the decades that impose the obligation of automatic forfeiture for pensions. Isn't that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And even
and in that Skeena, case- and let's go back to the deferred compensation comment that you made before. Spina mentions deferred compensation among a number of other labels that it says have been used in the past and says how it's not profitable to try to identify any one label as a perfect fit for these pensions. So I'm not sure that Spina stands for the proposition that it is one thing and one thing only. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree, Your Honor. You're totally correct. And in fact, in Spina, the issue was,
the issue dealt with the consolidation of local pension funds into a state system and how those monies were going to be dealt with the remaining fund.
Right. And it had absolutely nothing to do with forfeiture on account of dishonorable service. And in fact, footnote one distinguishes those cases.
Correct.
For all these reasons, the state totally agrees with defendant that this court can easily resolve these issues by its own precedent.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or any other questions for members of the court? Thank you.
No, thank you, Your Honor.
You asked for rebuttal, counsel? You're muted.
Can you hear me now? Thank you. I think just a few points tying into Justice Albin's question about the 18 years. If in fact counsel for the state is correct, then what she would be effectively asking for, saying you lose the whole pension, even though the crime was committed after the statute was enacted, you're basically arguing for a full retroactive effect of the statute, which I think we can all agree there's a very strong presumption against. I think it's important in terms of how, on this rather complex issue, how pensions are defined, what are they? Are they stemming from statute? Are they stemming from contract? Are they property rights? I think it's important to remember the fact that this is a case of first impression here in New Jersey. To my knowledge, except for an unpublished case, Seminole, the Eighth Amendment challenge has never been made before. So the court has never really been asked to hone in and figure out what constitutes property the way it has been here. And one thing I will say in response to something Justice Solomon said is, as a matrimonial practitioner, yes, the family court is a court of equity, but it is also a court of law. And if you look at Whitfield versus Whitfield, the reasoning wasn't so much, we've just got to do what's fair here. It looked at the very nature of a pension, and I think Justice Albin's questions highlight that. You don't just get it on the last day. You don't just earn it on the last day. That defies the basic nature of a pension, which is earned each and every day. And I believe Justice Patterson said, well, if somebody passes away, they don't have the right. But you know, I think it's important to point out that, for example, a lot of public pensions, there's insurance. There's insurance on some of these policies and others don't, but the fact—
My question wasn't about passing away, counsel, just to be clear. If someone simply works for 10 years and there's a 20-year requirement for them to earn a pension under whatever system they're under, and they leave, they have worked for 10 years, you could perhaps say that was a form of deferred compensation, but they didn't do everything they had to do to earn their pension. Okay. So they don't have that in that case you might say it's deferred compensation, but it's compensation they don't have a right to. I didn't mean when someone dies. That's a little bit
okay. I'm sorry. Then I did mishear you. Okay. So, but I think this case.
So, counsel, you're a matrimonial attorney.
Yes, I am.
Okay. So maybe you can answer this for me in the Whitfield context. So a matrimonial judge, as part of equitable distribution, divides up a pension. But the person earning the pension the next year commits an offense that leads to the forfeiture of the entire pension. What is there to divide up then?
Okay, so this is a very interesting question.
Then everyone's coming back to court under changed circumstances motion.
I would think so. And changed circumstances generally applies to support. But I will say this as a matrimonial practitioner. What happens routinely, and I hope this answers your question and maybe in a more expansive way, is pensions are valued. Including unvested pensions are valued. They're given a dollar figure, and the pensioner is given the option of buying out the other side. Now, they often do that, and a pension is required, and this is why I asked the court to remain consistent with New Jersey law, is pensions, including unvested pensions, are required to be listed on your case information statement. Now, under your scenario, it's a robust, if you do not list an unvested pension on your CIS, you are likely inviting a reopening of the whole divorce case, okay? So it's that much of an asset. It's that well understood that it's an asset. Now, in your scenario, Justice Albin, in your hypothetical, yes. And it's interesting because the state kind of mentioned this in their brief and referred to it as an open question. If somebody's going to divorce their wife and then lose their pension, the wife relied on those pension payments to support herself post-divorce, there absolutely could be intervention by the court to reshape either the party's agreement or the trial court's decision, especially if it's a decision. So I think the fact that a pension is an asset, and a lot has been said
counsel,
here.
Although the court may change the equitable distribution, change the property settlement agreement, the court cannot provide for means for the individual to obtain that pension. They can make changes, they can add other things. However, the court can never ever say, well, no, we instruct that the pension be reinstated, can they?
No, they can. They cannot, right. So I think it's so important to—
But doesn't your point, the way you just explained it, and you're an expert in this area, underscore the fact that no one knows whether this money will ever arrive? And if somebody, and if there is a change and it is not going to be, it is not going to be forthcoming from the state for whatever reason, then of course the equitable distribution has to be redone because it doesn't exist. I mean, doesn't that underscore that this is not something that just because there are expectations about it, and it may very well happen, is a given. It may or may not arrive.
It's treated as an asset, even if it's unvested in the matrimonial proceeding.
Understand, but if it if things happen, and there are a lot of things that can cause it to happen, so that the money is not going to arrive, then you're indicating, it makes complete sense to me, not an expert in that area. Then the court revisits the distribution of assets, because that asset that it was relying on has evaporated. And now we have to look at other assets, and maybe everybody goes home with less. That underscores that this is not a certainty, and there is no legal guarantee that the money is going to be forthcoming. Isn't that correct?
Well, to be clear, the court may or may not reopen, but I think it's important to remember that in this case, Benny Anderson was collecting and was
scammed. Yeah.
Okay. And I think that jumps out. I mean, to me, that's what jumps out in terms of whether or not the Eighth Amendment applies. You have an individual here who was collecting, was getting paid by his former employer, by the pension board. And then the state came in and took his money. And I'd like to also address—
But they didn't take the money he'd already collected. Right?
No, they did not.
They're saying you've collected that money. It's yours. It's only what's going forward that hasn't been paid to you yet that we're going to take away from us.
That is.
Or, so that's a distinction that sort of makes the same point, doesn't it?
I would disagree, Judge. I would think that because he was in collection and it was redirected, I think that makes this issue unique. And I think that makes that stood out to the appellate division. I also hearken back to the fact that we really have to look at what the nature of it is. And we don't call it, you know, deferred compensation that's not a meaningless expression, okay? That's something that Benny Anderson, he did not receive that money. And then when he started receiving it later, it was taken away. So I think that those are issues that jump out. I asked the court to pay close attention, because all of these issues, I think, and concerns—
Counsel, if I could just remind you, this is rebuttal, and we're getting past 2 minutes, well past 2 minutes, but I know you've got a lot of questioning, so—
I'm partly responsible for that.
No, that's fine.
I'm a matrimonial practitioner, so I apologize.
I just want, if you could move on to your next point. You said you had another point to make.
I just had one other point, and which is that, you know, the fact that Benny Anderson conceded when Jersey City seized his pension, to me, does not highlight the fact that this is inviolate. That was a partial seizing. To me, it highlights the fact that there can be proportionality. If it stopped there, perhaps that would be a constitutionally sound result. And with that, I conclude.
You rest?
I rest, sorry.
Okay. Ms. Bonfiglio, you said you might want to finish. Okay. Counsel, thank you. The court will take this under advisement. We